It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at what the famous marshmallow tests of the 60s could teach us about grit and willpower 50 years on.
First, today is the last day to campaign before polls open tomorrow morning, and gubernatorial candidates Mary Burke and Scott Walker are crisscrossing the state making final bids for votes.
Our reporter's been following their final day of campaigns. Maureen McCollum was with Scott Walker in Onalaska this morning. Danielle Kading was with Mary Burke in Superior this afternoon. We'll hear from both of them, starting with Maureen McCollum, following the Walker campaign today. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
So what was the scene like at that campaign event in Onalaska?
You could definitely tell it was the day before the election. A lot of times these Walker campaign stops, you know, generally they're at a business or a manufacturing facility. They might include a tour. He'll talk with some of the workers. This one, you know, they had the stage. They had the big sound system blasting music. You know, they had about 100 supporters and also workers at the facility. Today was at L.B. White. It's a heating manufacturer in Onalaska. But about 100 people gathered just to listen to Walker and the others just talk about why he should be reelected and have his administration in power for the next 4 years.
Now, this is one of, I think each candidate was making 5 or 6 stops today. So it sounds like what you're saying is they didn't take a lot of time to check out the scenery while they were there.
Walker's making 6 stops today, and they had no time for media afterwards. But I must say Walker, Lieutenant Governor Clayfish and her family, and Congressman Ryan, they did spend about 15, 20 minutes talking with supporters afterwards. They left once basically the last people left, so I think they did a lot of handshaking, photo taking. I saw a lot of autographs given. Not much sightseeing, but I think they're trying to talk with as many supporters as they can in these final hours.
Now, I would imagine that the candidates are choosing their sites very carefully with just one day left. Any thoughts on why Onalaska was important to the campaign?
I have heard that La Crosse, at least the La Crosse area, can be a bit of a swing area. You know, the city of La Crosse itself can usually lean Democratic, but Onalaska, it's a suburb, can be a little more conservative. Currently, its state representative is a Democrat, but before that, it was Mike Hipsch, who obviously is now in the Walker administration, who's a Republican. So, you know, that area can kind of lean a little more Republican, and I think they need as many Republican supporters from that region as possible.
And what were the primary messages in the program part, in the speaking part?
Well, you know, we heard from Congressman Paul Ryan. We heard from Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish and, of course, Governor Walker. And they all really touted Walker's tax reforms. Walker talked quite a bit about how he froze tuition for the UW systems. They all talked about the state surplus and deficit, which I know there are a lot of different ideas about there about how to really define that. But, you know, Walker's big thing was he wants 4 more years to keep the economic recovery going in Wisconsin and 4 more years of bringing his ideas into how our state's working. And he really focused a lot on future generations, which I haven't heard him say much. And I think he was really going for the emotional appeal, especially when he was, you know, he had his sons up on stage with him and saying how 4 more years of him will make a better future for his sons and other young people in Wisconsin.
A lot of the talk in this campaign has been about jobs, job creation, job growth, and dueling job numbers. Any talk about that today?
Yeah, he talked, you know, about job creation. There was no reference to the 250,000, but they threw a couple numbers out there. He really talked about how the Cooley region here around the La Crosse area has fared better economically, and especially the job situation has compared to other parts of the state. So, you know, he said today, as he said in other stops, that, you know, people can look to the Cooley region as a place where job reform is working. And, you know, he talked about how L.B. White in the last handful of years has been able to add jobs, and he took some credit for that. And when I talked with supporters afterwards, a lot of them said that jobs in the economy was the number one issue that was driving them to the polls tomorrow.
Any talk about voter turnout, speaking of being driven to the polls tomorrow?
He really didn't mention that, but I think he had some assumption that those who were at the rally would be turning out to vote. I kind of thought that he would be pushing that a little more, but it was mostly he stuck to the issues at hand with taxes and jobs and, you know, just bringing him on for another 4 years.
Maureen, thanks a lot for painting a picture of what went on there today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's Maureen McCollum, our reporter in La Crosse. We turn now to Danielle Kading. She's a WPR reporter up in Superior. Danielle, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. Well, you were at a Mary Burke event today in Superior. Can you set the scene for us? What was going on there?
Yeah, Mary Burke came in and she was carrying a few boxes of pizza for all the supporters that were there at the Douglas County Democrats office on Tower Avenue in Superior today. And she met with folks and hugged some folks, shook hands, and basically just made the rounds talking to people about what's important, trying to keep people energized. You know, northwestern Wisconsin is typically a Democratic stronghold. And so I think she just wanted to make sure that people are, as she said, going, putting in 110% and making sure that they're not experiencing fatigue with some of the negative attack ads that have been going on out there. She talked about there being way too much money and big money in attack ads right now, and wanted people to get out there and vote and say that that's not going to be a deciding factor, that people are going to have their say. And has been really pushing in the last couple of weeks where she said it's been pretty nasty is how she characterized it. And she says anytime when people ask her about how she's doing on the campaign trail, she just says, I tell them I'm doing fantastic. The tougher they hit, the tougher I hit.
And so this wasn't so much a reach out to the public event as an effort to rally the core supporters who are going to be probably, you know, maybe knocking on doors or making phone calls tomorrow?
They're definitely going to be heading out, knocking on doors, making phone calls, and doing lit drops with their base and making sure that they're getting people out there to vote. I think she just wanted to make sure that people were still feeling energized and excited about the election tomorrow. And not just losing that energy as the campaign is coming into its final days.
And we've heard a lot about turnout in various parts of the state being key. That sounds like it was her theme here as well.
Yes, definitely. I think we even talked to the Superior City Clerk last week, and they're seeing higher than average turnout for a governor's race. Usually it's around 50% to 60%, and I think they said that they're hoping for 80%. So they're just looking to get as many people out from their base as possible to head to the polls and cast their votes tomorrow.
So at this event in Superior, did Mary Burke touch on any of the issues in the race for governor?
She did. She talked a lot about education. She's campaigning on giving people in the state a fair shot to get ahead, and she talked about having education being a big part of that from kindergarten all through university, so funding public schools. She says a lot of people are being priced out of a higher education, and also she talked about equal opportunities for women. Also, with the lagging economy, she said in Wisconsin that she wants to make sure that there's opportunities for job growth. And supporters for Burke talked about her track record, both with Trek in the private sector and also her work bringing jobs back to the Park Falls paper mill when she was Commerce Secretary under Governor Jim Doyle. And so they're really trying to paint a picture that she is the woman for the job and she can get things done, despite some claims recently about her track record with Trek, about her possibly being fired. She denounced that today and said that those are outright lies from a campaign with a career politician looking to do anything to win this election.
So she did tackle the controversies that have been out there on the campaign trail.
Yeah, she said, you know, consider the source. She said it was an employee that left the company and is a big supporter of Governor Walker. She also said that as far as any dispute over the numbers that she raised as far as $3 million to $50 million during her term with Trek, that those numbers are out there and that they speak for themselves and that she's proud of her track record.
So this was the last day of campaigning for Mary Burke. We heard from Maureen that Governor Walker had six stops set today, including on Alaska. Does Mary Burke, do you know, have a similar itinerary?
Yeah, she's got five stops today. She's already been in Eau Claire, Superior, and is in Stevens Point now, unless she's already headed out for Green Bay and Madison. Those are her last two stops today.
And any major issues that you think voters in that part of the state are looking at in this race?
You know, I think it's always going to be jobs. Jobs, education, health care has been a major theme, at least for the Burke campaign. especially taking Walker to task on turning down federal funds as part of that health care exchange. So I think they're trying to get the message out that Burke's the woman for the job.
Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
We've been speaking with WPR reporter Danielle Kading from our bureau in Superior. She covered Mary Burke's campaign stop there today. We were also joined by WPR reporter Maureen McCollum from our bureau in La Crosse talking about Governor Walker's visit to Onalaska.
Rob, you like marshmallows, right?
Yeah, I like them all right.
And everybody likes marshmallows, more or less. And if someone, Rob, were to offer you a marshmallow and said you could eat it right away if you wanted to, or you could choose to wait a while and get two marshmallows, which would you choose?
Marshmallows, I can wait a while. And I've done a pretty good job at putting off the Halloween candy this year, too.
Uh-huh. Well, you may recognize this as the now famous marshmallow test from the 60s, which measured self-control and willpower in children. And by the way, if you haven't seen the test, you can check out the video on the Central Time Facebook page.
What made that test so iconic was that it seemed down the road to be a predictor of success later in life. Psychologist Walter Michel, who conducted the test, tracked the children in his studies into adulthood and found that those who had waited for that second marshmallow were generally healthier, scored higher on SAT tests, and coped better with stress.
Walter Michel is with us now. He's a psychologist specializing in personality theory and social psychology. He's also a professor at Columbia University and the author of a new book called The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control. Walter, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's very nice to talk with you.
Could you explain briefly how this marshmallow test worked?
Well, it's simplicity itself. The children are given actually a choice, not just between marshmallows, one or two now or two later, but between all kinds of goodies, because all kids don't like marshmallows. Some prefer Oreo cookies, and some prefer mints or graham crackers, so we have a whole wide variety of goodies that they can choose from. When the child has chosen, I really want that, we also ask, do you want one or do you want two? And virtually all children say they'd rather have the two. And then the question becomes, okay, you can have this one, Oreo cookie, for example, right away, or these two, also left in front of the child. When I come back, I have to go out of the room for a while. Then the child can ring a bell any time, bring me right back into the room, or just begin to eat the one marshmallow or the one Oreo cookie or the one whatever they've chosen, and then they don't get the two. That's it. And we measure how many seconds they wait. And what we discover from it, of course, is not simply that this the seconds of delay time that they choose to wait links to a variety of interesting things in the course of their life stories. But much more importantly, we learn from what they do while they're waiting some very important things about the mental mechanisms, and now more recently, in our more recent work, the brain mechanisms that make it possible for children and for adults to exert self-control and self-discipline and to take the future into account and to wait successfully for delayed outcomes or to work successfully for delayed outcomes. And the important part of the work really is that we've learned to understand what they're doing that makes this possible. And what it involves is something called executive function or executive control, which is done in the prefrontal cortex. And it involves keeping a delayed goal in mind. I'm waiting for the two cookies. It involves, secondly, inhibiting responses that interfere with that. I'm not going to think how chewy and crunchy and sweet they are. And I'm not going to touch them or get them near my mouth. And the third thing it involves is the use of imagination and attention regulation to make what would otherwise be an unbearably frustrating and boring delay time more fun. And then what we learn when we watch what they do is that they transform the situation by distracting themselves, by looking away, turning around in their chairs so that they don't see the goodies, and by beginning to explore their nasal canals and their ear canals and toying with what they find there and singing little songs, oh, this is my home in Redwood City, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, one big question this raises for me is self-control fixed from one person to the next? That is one kid possessing self-control and they're going to be like that forever, another kid built in less self-control and there's no changing?
One of the most important things we learned is that there's a great deal of changing. And that self-control is quite easily learned and quite easily manageable, particularly early in life, by learning the cognitive skills that make it possible. And those cognitive skills involve exactly the kinds of distraction techniques or the ways of transforming the situation to make something that is very difficult and very effortful actually very easy and very possible.
And part of the reason that this has been such an iconic test over the years is that you check back in with the success of these kids later and they had better outcomes later on. So it seems as though there is something about willpower that correlates with success later in life.
Yeah, there's something about executive control or executive function that correlates with success later in life, because kids who are able to wait or work for two cookies or two marshmallows later are also going to be much better prepared to learn in school. They're going to be much better prepared to deal with negative emotions like their own temper, their own angry feelings, and so on, to regulate their emotions. So, yes, the cognitive skills that make it possible to wait for two cookies are fundamentally the same as the cognitive skills that make it possible to succeed in school, to succeed in social relationships, and to do well in the pursuit of one's goals over the life course.
Well, Walter, I wonder if you can help us put this into practice with a very timely test. Say I've got a big bowl of Halloween candy sitting on my front table while trick-or-treaters are coming, and I really don't want to eat very much of that candy. And I know it's there. What kind of tricks and tactics can I use to harness my self-control and not be sick by the end of Halloween night?
Well, I mean, the first thing you might want to do is get them out of your sight. Cover them up with something and put them on a high shelf where they're hard to reach and put them out of your mind.
This isn't just about food, though, right? This isn't just ways that we can, you know, not eat the unhealthy food. This is kind of a metaphor for everything in life that's worth waiting for, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the marshmallows that are the temptations for adults are not the same as the marshmallows that are in temptations for 4- and 5-year-olds. But we all face both external temptations, and we also face our own emotions that are troubling for us and that we have difficulty regulating and controlling, so that when we express them, we want to try to express them in a constructive rather than in a destructive way. So again, this executive function or executive control is the fundamental mechanism that's very important to learn and as early in life as possible. And as I say, the good news is that this is not genetically predetermined. There are huge individual differences starting early in life in how easy this is for different people. But no matter how hard or easy it is, self-control can be enhanced and learned by relatively simple techniques that include various ways of planning, of making specific strategies for avoiding the chocolate mousse that you've chosen not to have. And yet when the waiter flashes it in front of me, at least, unless I have a very specific plan to order the fruit salad instead, my good resolution, my good intention dissolves the moment the thing gets near me.
Briefly before the news, can we exhaust our self-control? Is it finite for a limited period of time?
Well, it's like everything else. It's fatiguing to exert self-control. And we have different standards that we develop in terms of how much we want to exert before it's time to eat the cookies or eat the marshmallows or have the cocktail. So there are differences in the ease with which we can continue to exert reasonable self-control, or the points at which we're ready to say it's time to ring the bell, time to eat the cookies.
Well, we're talking right now about the results of the 60s marshmallow tests and what they can teach us about building grit and building self-control. We have found, our researchers found, that later in life, people who have more self-control have better outcomes. And we're talking about strategies to optimize that and build greater reservoirs of self-control.
Psychologist Walter Michel stays with us after the news, and we'd love to hear from you as well. How important is delayed gratification, do you think, for success in life? How do you cultivate willpower, and where does it fall down for you? What is it that overcomes your powers of self-control. How do you try to teach these traits to kids? Have you tried this? Do you have an example in your life where you used your willpower, your self-control to make a change? Quitting smoking, maybe, or staying focused on your studies or on the job for that matter. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post to share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the marshmallow test and the importance of self-control and willpower in our lives.
And you can join our conversation. Do you believe willpower can be learned, can be cultivated? And what strategies do you use to cultivate greater self-control? How do you teach these traits to your kids? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us a tweet at Central Time WPR.
Walter Michel stays with us. He's the psychologist who conducted the original marshmallow tests in the late 60s, followed up with them when the subjects were adults. His new book, by the way, is called The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control. And we'll go right to a caller. We've got Jennifer on the line in La Crosse. Jennifer, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, Jennifer?
Well, I was just listening to your program, and it reminded me of when I quit smoking back in 1997. What I actually did was when I would get stressed or worried or bothered or whatever, I would, instead of picking up the cigarette, I would actually go for a walk. I would take the dog outside, or I would maybe run around the block or start doing jumping jacks, and that helped me. That really helped me with getting over the cravings. And I'm just saying that, you know, distraction is huge in my opinion. So that's all I wanted to say.
Jennifer, thank you so much for that call. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Walter, that sounds like it fits right in with what you were talking about how to avoid that temptation earlier.
Absolutely. What Jennifer is doing is an adult version of what the kids are doing when they deliberately self-distracted themselves every time they were tempted to start eating the marshmallow. And she gave some wonderful examples of how to do it. And it sounds to me very, very similar to what the children do when they're 4 and 5 years old who manage to wait. They distract themselves and they create all kinds of imaginative things like singing songs and exploring their toes and playing piano on their toes as if they were piano keys and so on. Jennifer gave wonderful examples.
So the one thing not to do, though, as I understand it, is to concentrate on actively resisting the cigarette.
Or to either concentrate on actively resisting it, because what you're likely to do is focus on how tempting it would be to puff on it and have it come through your nostrils and into your head. So by putting any attention on it, you're likely to focus on its hot, tempting features, not on its long-term consequences. If you want to focus on the cigarette, think about the long-term effects and imagine what your lungs will look like 20 years down the line. Imagine it vividly as the x-rays being shown to you and you're told that you've got metastasized lung cancer.
Now, I want to get back to our callers, but a question on this. So the marshmallow experiment, the smoking example, in a way, those are both examples of won't power, where you're delaying gratification. What about if you actually want to use your willpower to do something actively that you need to do? Does it work the same way?
Well, if you in that case, what you really need is an intense goal and a plan for how to reach it. So the cognitive skills that are needed to reach a delayed goal are exactly the ones we were talking about before, namely the skills that enable executive function, keeping the goal in mind, inhibiting any responses that interfere with it, like going off task, and monitoring your progress to it, and making sure that you're using your imagination, your attention control skills, and your work habits in order to keep moving towards it.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Andy with us in Jefferson. Andy, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Two quick things. One thing I do to avoid eating too many chocolates, I'll go grab them, then go sit down, eat them. That way I'm too lazy to get up and go after them again. But the other one was, this study was done in the late 60s, and I was just wondering, with the society that seems to want this instant gratification right away. How do you think the study, if you did it now, how would that study differ than when it was done in the 60s?
Well, it's not actually if we did it. We are doing those studies. My book deals not simply with the experiments in the 1960s. It starts with that, and then it goes, of course, to the 50 years of work that we and many other psychologists and neuroscientists have been doing currently. And what we're finding, of course, is that there are more temptations than ever in the world, but that there are all kinds of things that are happening also in education and in technology that are allowing people to develop very good self-control skills. So both the temptations are going up and the opportunities to learn the necessary skills for self-control are also going up.
Well, thank you for that call. Let's move next to Rick in Grafton. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how you doing? One of the hardest things I ever did in my life was quit smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. And what I ended up was focusing on 2 things at once, a positive and a negative. The positive was what I could buy by saving the money if not smoking. And the number 2, having did research on what smoking does to you, and then witnessing 2 relatives that died as a direct result of smoking. So those 2 things there. But the other question I have is with ADD or ADHD type diagnostics with people, do you find that they have lower self-control for delayed gratification?
Okay, thank you for your questions, Rick. And this is something that resonates with you, right, Walter? I thought I read that you would also quit smoking.
As a matter of fact, what Rick was saying describes very, very closely what I myself did when I was a 3-pack-a-day smoker. And this was 50 years ago. And I did exactly what he's talking about, which is to particularly, in my case, focus on the delayed consequences by keeping an image in my mind of what I saw at the medical school at Stanford University, where I was working at the time, when I saw a man being wheeled on a gurney, his chest bare, his head shaved with little green X marks all over it. And I asked the nurse, what's going on here? And she said, well, this man has metastasized lung cancer, and the little green marks is where the radiation goes. So when I quit smoking, I kept that image vividly in my head every time that I was tempted to approach a cigarette. And at the same time, I made smoking cigarettes quite disgusting for myself by inhaling deeply from a tobacco can so that the nicotine was so intense it became unpleasant, not unlike the strategies that Rick was talking about.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. We go now to Jackie with us in Oshkosh. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about the self-control. My granddaughter goes to first grade up here, and her teacher did a wonderful experiment last week. She turned on the bubble machine, and all the kids are up jumping around. You know, a bunch of six-year-olds. They're popping bubbles and everything. Then she turned it off, and she told the kids to have a seat and to try and sit as long as they possibly could without popping a bubble. She turned on that bubble machine, and it was interesting to see the different control some of the kids have and some don't have.
Very interesting. What do you think of that? Have there been experiments like that, Walter, a bubble machine type test?
I'm not aware of any bubble machine experiments, but it doesn't sound at all uninteresting.
Well, Walter, whether we're talking about bubble machines or marshmallow tests, say you've got a kid who demonstrates not much self-control, you want them to have those benefits later in life. What can a parent, a teacher, do for a kid who doesn't show much self-control?
Well, I mean, the first thing that parents can do is, of course, is to model it in their own behavior. There are many times when there are parents who, for example, don't keep their promises. If that's the case, there's every reason for their child not to be eager to delay gratification for outcomes that he or she doesn't expect to get because the promises haven't been kept. So the way we as parents model self-control in our own lives and exhibit it in front of our children has a huge influence of what our children learn and become. The second thing is that in order for anybody to want to delay gratification, there has to be a motivation to do so. So asking yourself what are the goals that your child might be interested in self-controlling for is sort of a first step in identifying where you need to put your attention.
And those are children. What about adults? Same thing?
Very, very much so, in the sense that if there are self-controlled areas in which you want to change, for example, we've heard smoking examples, we've heard overeating examples, then the next step is, if the motivation is serious, is to specify what's called an if-then plan, so that if I'm about to reach for the cookies, then I, you know, go for the banana instead. So unless there are specific strategies of that kind, for example, through plans in which there is a connection made between the temptation and the response that you're going to make that will avoid the temptation, you don't have a chance. So there are a variety of strategies from planning to self-distancing to changing the meaning of the temptation in, by how you think about it, that are described in my book. And while that can't be told in the couple of minutes that we have, the book is full of such illustrations.
Well, Walter, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was psychologist Walter Michel. He's a professor in the Department of Psychology at Columbia University and the author of the new book, The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control.
Veronica, should I try this with my daily cookie?
No, because you always share your cookie with me.
All right. So I have reinforcement there to keep getting it. It's time for Wisconsin Life. U.S. entry into World War I in 1917 fueled a wave of anti-German sentiment across Wisconsin and the nation. The fervor was particularly acute in Milwaukee, the most German city in the country. Historian John Goethe tells us how German Americans bore the brunt of war.
Germans were the largest ethnic group in Milwaukee, and they had been since 1860. This was by no means the only one, but this had the most sophisticated dramatic groups, art societies, music societies, and it had an image as the German Athens, the Deutsche Athen of America. They were diverse, but they were united by their sense of solidarity as German speakers. There would have been a relatively united front in the early years of support for the German homeland. And you have to remember, this is the home team. This is, in many cases, the country people had left still remember. They still spoke the language. So there were portraits of Kaiser Wilhelm on many living room walls, dining room walls in Milwaukee and throughout Wisconsin. And it also now, obviously, you look back and you say that's the enemy. But in the early years of the war, from 1914 to the time the U.S. jumped in 1917, Woodrow Wilson's declaration was, we are neutral in fact as well as in name. So people were free to express their support for the German and Austrian cause. The U.S. enters the war on April 17, and almost overnight, you have this propaganda campaign rolling into high gear, and the goal was to rid Milwaukee of every last vestige of Germanism. And there are these savage cartoons of the bloody Hun, you know, the German as butcher. German language instruction was banned from the public schools. The local orchestras could no longer perform Bach or Beethoven or Brahms. The statue of Germania, which stood atop the Brumder Building in downtown Milwaukee, was taken down. Some of the name changes, you look back now and they're almost humorous, but the probably the best private school in Milwaukee was the German English Academy, and they had to change their name to the Milwaukee University School. You have the Deutscher Club, which was among the really, you know, highly regarded social clubs in Milwaukee. They changed their name from the Deutscher Club to the Wisconsin Club, and so they've been ever since. You had a lot of Schneiders who changed their names to Taylor, and a lot of Schmitz who became Smith. The Milwaukee Journal had a reporter named Perry Olds, and his self-appointed job was to read the stories in the German language press in Milwaukee and kind of analyze their war coverage. And then he would write, obviously, in English in the Milwaukee Journal, what he considered exposés of pro-Axis sentiment. Actually kind of an enemy inside the gates is what it amounted to. And emphasized this was not just a Milwaukee phenomenon. the Pulitzer Prize committee said, what a great idea, and gave the journal a Pulitzer back in 1919, after the war by that time, but it was in recognition for the journal's efforts to expose and root out German sympathizers. German culture was pretty much cut off at the knees. When you think of German culture here, you think in terms of kind of the bass note. You know, it's not the melody, it's kind of the bass note.
Wisconsin in the First World War, a special Wisconsin Life series, continues all this month. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30 p.m.
Now we dig deeper into how anti-German sentiment during World War I affected the lives of people here in Wisconsin. As we just heard John Goerde, he joins us now. John, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So tell us a little more about how German Milwaukee was in the years, the early years of World War I.
The first year that the Germans were in the majority in Milwaukee was back in 1860, and they remained at least half of the population through all those years. To this day, people of German background are about 38% of the metro area's population, which is still the highest in the country. Obviously, there's a lot less self-identifying than there was back in the years around World War I, a century ago. But this has always been a real stronghold, as Wisconsin has, of German settlement.
So was it, a big wave of Germans in that first part and they hung on to their identity? Or did we keep seeing more Germans follow their predecessors into the area?
It was more the latter. It was more the chain migration. You have the first wave is the years 1830s, 40s, 50s. The first Germans arrived here in Milwaukee back in 1839, which is, that's 7 years before Milwaukee becomes a city. So they really dig it into the ground floor. And you have that first massive wave in the mid-1800s, but it continued through the later 1800s, although it was less robust than the emigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. And there were also people who had been displaced by World War I, and later on people who had been displaced by World War II. So the Donauschwaben, the Danube Germans especially. So there still there are multi-generational families in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, you know, who trace their roots back to Germany.
Now, a lot of that time period you're talking about back in Europe was the time when all these disparate German principalities and whatnot were unifying. German nationalism was on the rise. Were people here in Wisconsin watching what was going on there, maybe even actively participating as much as they could in the politics of the homeland?
Not so much. There was the big kind of a watershed was 1848, when there was a revolt against royal rule in Germany. And it was the intellectuals, people who had college educations, which was quite rare back in those years, who were in the vanguard, actually on the barricades. And they won for a while. The royalist forces pushed back, and they exiled the so-called 48ers. And a lot of them came to Milwaukee. They were never a huge group. But they were a little like yeast and bread. They really helped the whole body rise. So the 48ers, people like Carl Schurz, you know, the famous Wisconsinite, served in Lincoln's cabinet. They were the ones who were behind the dramatic societies, the arts groups, the musical groups. So they really did help to make Milwaukee the Deutschaffen. But then 1871 is the year when all those fiefdoms and principalities and duchies and kingdoms are united as Germany. And that was not so much a popular movement as Bismarck saying, you shall. So it was not a democratic movement. And certainly people followed that. But I think, as it is for virtually every immigrant group, they were emigrating largely for economic reasons. You know, there were issues of overpopulation and lack of opportunity in the old country. So they came to the U.S. and specifically to Wisconsin because they thought they could live better here.
Well, moving up to World War I, it sounds like a really dramatic, fast shift where all these German groups were out and about and doing their thing and commenting on World War I. And then all of a sudden, when the United States went to war, very much out of favor. Was it really such an overnight shift?
It turned on a dime. And to show you how open the support was, there was a bazaar back in 1916 that filled the Milwaukee Auditorium. And it was benefits for the relief of what they described as German and Austrian war sufferers. So the wives and children of soldiers who had fallen already in the conflict. And this was sponsored by people like the Blatzes and the Brumders and the Vogels, a lot of other leading German families. And they drew 175,000 people. and that was about half the population. And they raised, oh, about $150,000, which would be, no, I don't know, maybe a few million today. So that was just a very open and accepted show of support for what was the home team for the German immigrants here. And then we jumped in on April 17th, 1917, and almost overnight, you know, it was just that would have been considered the height of treason, basically. So it really did turn on a dime.
And how did the German Americans in Milwaukee and elsewhere in the state respond? Did they push back? Did they try to demonstrate their patriotism, or just try to keep their heads down?
They tried to keep their heads down, and the people are largely gone now. But I recall back in the 1970s talking to some older Milwaukeeans who said that they used to have to, when they were downtown shopping or on errands, they used to have to duck into doorways to speak German, because if you were even heard speaking German on the streets, people would look at you askance. So this was, the word hysteria is not an exaggeration. It really was kind of a mass anti-German hysteria. So pushing back would have been decidedly imprudent.
How would you say that World War I and this anti-German hysteria changed our culture in the long run here in Wisconsin?
The main impact it had was it kind of, in a very, very important ways, denature is perhaps too strong a word, but it certainly compromised what had been a self-conscious German culture, both in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin and in the entire country. For decades before that time, there had been just a real strong sense of cultural confidence, if not superiority. And after the war, that was really pretty much eradicated. You know, there was, back in the 1970s, 80s, I was working on a directory of ethnic resources in the Milwaukee area, and there was one woman who described herself as a speaker, an expert on German culture, and she added the qualifier before World War I. And that really tells you something. You know, there was, after the war, there was not an awful lot going on. Just, it's almost comic opera now, but there was after the war, this is October 1919, about a year after the war, the Pabst Theater was one of the finest German language stages, probably west of Berlin. And after the war, a year after the war, they made plans to stage Wilhelm Tell in the original mm-hmm. German. And there was a band of war veterans who actually aimed a cannon
wow.
at the theater and said, just try it.
John, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
That was John Goerde, Milwaukee historian, talking about anti-German hysteria in Wisconsin during World War I.